From Cambridge, Massachusetts, WHDH Public Affairs presents the Harvard Law School Forum. Tonight, recorded highlights on the topic, God and the Intellectual. Our guest speaker is the Most Reverend Fulton J. Sheen, Auxiliary Bishop of New York and National Director of the Society for the Propagation of the Faith. The moderator is the Reverend Charles Price, preacher to the university. Now, here's Reverend Price.
It's a deep pleasure and honor to welcome to the Harvard Law School Forum and to this community the Most Reverend Fulton J. Sheen, Auxiliary Bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of New York and National Director of the Society for the Propagation of the Faith. To tell you the truth, there are at least two Bishop Sheens to be introduced. One you know very well already and have known him for a long time. We remember him when he was Monsignor Sheen. We remember him as the star of that weekly television program in the early 1950s. We remember those lectures with the rare combination of wit and wisdom. We remember his great gifts of winsome persuasion. And we remember those chalk drawings done with rare artistic talent. One of my favorite Bishop Sheen stories is the story of the heckler who said to him, "Bishop Sheen, what was Jonah doing for 3 days in the belly of the whale?" And Bishop Sheen said, "I don't know. When I get to heaven, I'll ask him." But the heckler was not to be put off and said, "Suppose Jonah didn't get to heaven?" And Bishop Sheen answered, "Then you ask him." Bishop Sheen was an early representative of the era of good feelings among men of different religious traditions, the era in which we now enjoy. Most recently, Bishop Sheen was our television guide and commentator through Pope Paul's strenuous day in New York, and an indefatigable and resourceful guide he proved to be, a regular ecclesiastical Huntley and Brinkley show. But there is a second Bishop Sheen. The fact that he has been so much and so gracefully in the public eye should not lead us to overlook his intellectual attainments. He holds 2 earned doctorates. He won the prized Cardinal Mercier Award at the University of Louvain. For 24 years, he was the professor of philosophy at Catholic University. He has written some 60 books. He is one of the noted preachers of our day. In fact, he comes to us with all the necessary credentials to speak to us on this evening's subject, God and the Intellectual. Bishop Sheen, we're glad you're here. The floor is yours.
To doctors, friends. After that nice introduction, I could hardly wait to find out what I'm going to say. When there's an introduction of that kind, I often wonder if I am really the next speaker. I'm somewhat like a judge in Brooklyn who bore the name of Dunn. There was a stupid witness on the stand. Not that all stupid witnesses are from Brooklyn, but this particular one was. And the prosecuting attorney said to the stupid witness, "Were you at the corner of 4th and Elm the day of the accident?" "Who, me?" "Yes, you. Did you notice whether or not the woman was seriously injured?" "Who, me?" "Yes, you. Did you notice whether or not the ambulance came to care for the wounded woman?" "Who, me?" Well, by that time, the prosecuting attorney was exasperated, and he said, "Certainly you. Why do you think you're here?" He says, "I'm here to see justice done." Judge Dunn says, "Who, me?" This topic that I'm talking to you about this evening was assigned to me, God and the intellectual. Let's take first the intellectual. Have I any right to talk to you from the point of view of an intellectual? I doubt it, because one night a mother said to a little boy, she wanted to get him out from the kitchen. She said, go into the parlor, turn on television, Bishop Sheen is on, he's very smart, and you'll learn something. Well, at that particular moment, I was writing on the blackboard the word sex, not drawing it. I'm writing it. Did you know that I do draw so poorly that the New York Art School offered me a free scholarship? They really did. And I was writing the word sex on the board. The little boy came out to his mother and he said, he's not so smart. He doesn't know how to spell six. Then as for the subject of God, there was a man whose tire went flat on Fifth Avenue and he could not fix it, and he started to curse and blaspheme, and the cop pulled him in, and the judge said to him, would you say that you use the same language as Bishop Sheen uses? Would you say you use the same words? And he says, yes, Judge. He said, I would. But I arrange the words a little differently. Now, as for God and the intellectual, we are living in an age where the two do not so much go together. By that I mean that those who use rational and intellectual proofs for the existence of God have but little hearing. The intellectual approach to God has lost its appeal. Not that the arguments are not valid. They are. Just as valid as they ever were. The first book that I ever wrote was entitled God and Intelligence. And it was a defense of the intellectual attitude toward God against, well, for example, William James, who believed in religious experience, I bow to the new building, and Hans Vaihinger, Henry Bergson with his intuition and the like. Those arguments that were given then and have been given since will still convince truly intellectual men. But the intellectual or rational point of view has also been used by the atheists. As a matter of fact, the communist argument against God is rather a rational argument. And let me review for you how Karl Marx and communism came to their atheism, and you'll see how intellectual was the approach. Let him in, will you? We've just begun. He may be an intellectual. Karl Marx worked for his doctorate degree and received it at the University of Jena. And he had to study the German philosopher Hegel. Everybody had to study Hegel in those days. And so he wrote a philosophy that was called dialectical. And you know, Marx's PhD thesis for the university was so intellectual, so dialectical. By dialectical, I mean The second sentence contradicted the first, and the third united the first two. That's dialectics. And he ended it up by saying, I hate all the gods. Well, a few years after he published his doctoral degree, Ludwig Feuerbach wrote a book on materialism. Now, here was Marx, up in the air, only concerned about ideals and idealism. And here was Feuerbach coming along saying there's only matter. So Marx said, wouldn't it be a wonderful idea to marry off Hegel and Feuerbach and develop a theory called dialectical materialism? And that's what he did. He had a marriage ceremony. And he united the dialectics of Feuerbach, the dialectics, rather, of Hegel, with the materialism of Feuerbach, and produced his system. Now, that is very heavy, but the reason I did it is this. In every lecture, in order to convince people you're intellectual, you must always have 2 or 3 minutes in which you talk not very much sense. Otherwise, people will say, I understood everything he said. It's worth the price of admission alone to go home and to say to everybody, I found out what dialectical materialism was. If anybody asks you what is it, don't tell them. Keep it a secret. Marx now went on to argue this way. We must establish a new humanity. There are two things that are destroying humanity. One is belief in God, or religion, because when man believes in God, he becomes subservient to a creator. Secondly, man has another slavery. That slavery is brought about by private property. Private property makes a man dependent upon an employer. If, therefore, we are ever to have a new humanity, make man really free, we must get rid of two things. We must get rid of God and religion, and we must get rid of property. That is why, in communism, the economic system is inseparable from its atheism. Now, the point that I'm making is this. The intellectual approach has been used both to prove the existence of God and to attack God. Now we come to something new. Atheism is a mood of the present time. It is in the air. Popular. Is it intellectual? No. Does it come from reason? No. Do men prove that there is no God or that one should be atheistic? No. Why then the appeal? Here is the heart of my lecture. All of the thought about God in our present age has shifted from the intellect to the will. To the will. We have two faculties. One, the intellect or reason. The object of which is truth. The other faculty is the will. It is the faculty of choosing, of deciding. Its object really would be goodness. The modern man does not talk about God from the viewpoint of the intellect. He wills that there will be no God. And this is the so-called intellectual approach. It's not intellectual at all. Man has just decided that way. Now, who are the thinkers who have done this and who have opted for atheism? Well, there are two classes. One, what might be called the bourgeois atheists. And the other, the existential atheists. First, the bourgeois atheists are those who would say, well, our concepts of God that we had in the past are quite unsatisfactory. And they would therefore recommend throwing out the baby with the bath. Others would say we have to live a society today that is purely materialistic, and inasmuch as our culture is extremely affluent, we have no need of God. Sometimes the bourgeois atheists are not really so atheist. What they are complaining about very often is that we are not communicating properly the idea of God to others. And in this, there could be some truth. But the bourgeois atheist, I'm not going to dwell upon, because simply what they're saying in common language is, look, Ma, I'm blaspheming. But the others, the existential atheists, they are the ones who have made our modern atheistic mood. Beginning with Nietzsche, very few men have influenced the anti-religious world as much as the man who went mad in his anger against God. When Nietzsche was 14, he said, I had a vision of God. A vision of God in his splendor. And then later on, he said, I willed from this moment that there would be no God. And so he wrote Antichrist, and he put all of the words against the existence of God in the mouth of a madman. And Nietzsche, who could play the piano well, and who was a friend of Richard Wagner, one day was seated at his piano playing, and suddenly he lifted the fingers from the keys. And he began pounding the keys with his elbows, shouting, shrieking against the person of Christ, and was a madman until he died. But he willed that there would be no God. One finds somewhat the same thing in another writer who has influenced our atheistic mood, Sartre. Sartre said, I came to a point where I saw that if I was ever to be completely free, there could never be anyone on whom I was dependent. That's the atheism of the will, not of the mind. There's no reasoning there. Camus. Heidegger. If it could be mathematically proven that there was a God, I would still reject him because he would set a limit to my ego. Simone de Beauvoir. the common law wife of Sartre, who has written 3 volumes on her existentialism, says that I fear death, the fatality of all of my decisions. And she said that when she was 14 years of age, she decided, though she had a religious training, from this point on, I will that there will be no God. And she said, I wept. And she lived her life from that point on, based upon that decision. And in the last volume of her work, she looks back and says, I've been gypped. Dostoevsky, the great Russian novelist, has a character by the name of Kirillov. Kirillov was one of the precursors of modern communistic atheism. And Kirillov says at one point, there's only one way that I can really will the destruction of God, and that is to take my own life. Because, he said, if there is a God outside, he will decide when I die. I will destroy myself not because I want to kill myself, but in order that I may negate him. Now you see that even in this atheism, there is always an invoking of God. And even with the bourgeois atheists, they can't leave God alone. They have to talk about him. That was brought home to me some years ago in London. I did work in a downtown parish in Soho Square, London. And one Sunday morning, I was going into the church from the rectory, and hence coming into the church from the rear. And there was a young woman standing up in front of the communion rail haranguing the congregation. And she was saying, I circulate England, Scotland, and Wales with pamphlets denouncing a belief in God. Every night I get up in Hyde Park and talk against the existence of God. There's too much evil in the world, and so on and so forth. But this time I got up to the communion rail and I said, my dear lady, I'm very happy to hear that you're telling the congregation you believe in God. She said, you silly fool, I don't. Well, I said, I understood you to say just the contrary. I said, suppose I went across the street here to Soho Square and every night talked against 20-footed ghosts and 10-legged centaurs. Suppose I circulated England, Scotland, and Wales with pamphlets denouncing a belief and 20-footed ghosts and 10-legged centaurs, what would happen to me? She said, you'd be crazy. They would lock you up. I said, why don't they lock you up? Don't you put God in the same category? She said, yes. Well, I said, then why would I be crazy and not you? She said, I don't know. Why? Well, I said, because when I fight against a 20-footed ghost and a 10-legged centaur, I'm fighting against a figment of the imagination, and reason knows that. But when you're fighting against God, you're fighting against something just as real as the thrust of a sword or an embrace. I said, do you think we'd have any such thing as anti-cigarette laws unless there were cigarettes? I said, do you think we'd have any such thing as prohibition unless there was something to prohibit? I said, how can we have atheism unless there's something to atheate? She said, I hate you. Well, there was something of this in Kirillov, which brings me now to another point. Thus far, I have said that the intellectual approach to God is quite unpopular, and even the intellectual atheism is quite unpopular. Simply because men today are not using reason. Honestly, today, when you put your head between your hands to think out something, somebody asks you if you have a headache. And so that the atheism today is a willed atheism. What kind of a... Is it really atheism? Really? I'm not so sure. I believe that today the world is living not in an age of the presence of God, but in the age of the absence of God. Some know what it is to live in the presence of God. There's a sense of love. When a man is in love with a woman, even though she be not present, physically present, she is present in his memory, in his will, in his commitments, and in his involvement, and in his peace. He loves, he is loved. He has that certainty. And those who live in the presence of God have that same sense with God. They're happy. They're at peace. But today, modern minds are feeling the absence of God, the absence. And those who have most strongly willed that kind of atheism feel that absence and that unhappiness. Take, for example, Sartre. I said that their atheism is a willed atheism. As a matter of fact, they do not begin with atheism. They do not end with atheism. They begin with it. They say, this is where I start. But you study their writings. I'll take, for example, his play, We Clow. Four Souls in Hell. Sartre could write about hell better than anybody else, and he has, because he's there. As one of the French writers said, one of his contemporaries said, I feel myself in hell, therefore I am. And so Sartre said, each one wanted to talk about his own pains and aches. The others didn't listen. They could hardly wait until it was their turn to talk. And they wanted to talk only about themselves. And when the curtain goes down, the last line is, my neighbor is hell. And the Sartre puts it, why? He sets a limit to my ego. The very fact that you exist, you set a limitation to my being, to my will. See this unhappiness? This absence of God? And in the same description, someone in hell asked for a razor, a toothbrush. What do you want a toothbrush for? See, because according to these existentialists, life has no meaning. Well, if you're going to get a toothbrush, it simply isn't because you want to make a bank deposit. And so one of the other souls reminds him, why do you want a toothbrush? If you want a toothbrush, it has a certain purpose. And then you're beginning to admit a purpose, and you get one purpose after another, then life isn't meaningless. And then he says, oh, something must be wrong here. Sure, something was wrong. Life wasn't quite that meaningless. Take the play of Camus. Called La Peste. plague breaks out in a North African city. Dr. Rear builds a laboratory, a hospital, spends himself and is spent in caring for people. The plague momentarily stops. But Dr. Rear knows very well that the plague is in the clothes, it's in the furniture, and it's going to break out again. And that's the way life is. It has no purpose. It's meaningless. Here's a man who tried to serve humanity. And yet in the end, he was unhappy. Have all admitted an inner unhappiness and want of peace. All of them. And this is what the mood our world is in today. It's almost like describing the death of Christ, and he descended into hell, rose again to heaven, so that our age is really going down, feeling a want, an emptiness, an anxiety, a fear, a dread, that can be a creative despair. Really creative. And when one thinks of it in our Western world, and we would feel it less because we're affluent, but when one thinks of it in our Western world, one wonders maybe if Russia will not come to a quicker understanding of it than we will. When one reads the writings of what were called the Slavophiles, the Russian writers of the 19th century, Khmyakov, Leontief, Soloviev, all of them say that Russia would one day be possessed by an evil spirit. Dostoevsky went so far as to say that, to describe communism as if it were at his very door, simply because he saw evil at its worst when he was down in Siberia in this prison. And then, at the end, after describing all of this, he said, "Let me have the Gospel of Luke." He reads the passage about our blessed Lord driving out the devil from the young man into the swine. That was the first instance of deviled ham, too, incidentally. I couldn't help it. And he said, "Read this passage about the devil being driven into the swine." And Dostoevsky then goes on to say, "And this," he said, "is my Russia. My Russia that will become so full of devils. And one day the devils will be driven out. And they will be driven into the swine." He does not say who the swine are. "And the swine will be pushed back and back and back into the sea. And there they will be drowned, and it will be good enough for them. And Russia will sit at the feet of Christ and learn his gospel." Could it be the that the dream of these Slavophiles of the 19th century will one day come true? Or will this absence of God that we feel, this aching void, drive us back again to Him? We know not what turn the world is to take. But just sometimes make a study of the lives of those who have negated God. The best writers who have given the finest expression to their atheism and set in contrast with it men who enjoy the presence. Just 2 weeks ago, I finished giving a retreat to Trappist monks in Gethsemane, Kentucky. 154 monks. I do not believe you could get together 154 men anywhere in the United States, men that would be as normal as these 154 men, without a problem and absolute peace. Doctors, lawyers, metallurgists, chemists, one former nightclub pianist, another a bartender, a joy and a radiance about them that comes from the fact that they're charitable and they feel the presence of God. And so looking back then as an intellectual over the world as we have seen it, do not think that it is the intellectual men who are negating God. It's men who have just chosen to live without Him. There's nothing new in it. When you get home, pick up your New Testament. Read the first chapter of St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans, and you'll read everything that we know today from the bourgeois and the existential atheists. And you'll even see the correlation that he has between certain kinds of immorality, such as homosexuality, and a decline of the belief in God. It's all there. Therefore, I'm not despairing. Because we can do nothing with those who will to negate God in order to be free. Free as they call it. Pascal said, we would not be looking for God if we had not already found Him. Augustine, everyone knows his words, our hearts were made for thee. And they are restless until they rest in thee. Kierkegaard, great Danish thinker, says it takes eternity to make a man despair. Why is it pigs don't have complexes? Did you ever hear of a rooster with an Oedipus complex? Did you ever hear of a horse with an Oedipus complex? Why not? They just do not have that capacity for transcendence that we have. There was a classmate of mine when I was studying in Europe who told me that when he was 7 years old, he and another boy about his own age went out into the woods, and they thought they'd be men, and they made a little game among themselves to see who could think up the most curse words and the worst. And so they started with darn. And they worked up and up, and finally they were out and out atheists. and laughing and having a great time. Then he said they suddenly discovered that they were lost in the woods. And he said the two of them got down on their knees and prayed to the good Lord to get them out. Well, something like that could happen, too, to our civilization, that for the moment wills him not, but feels empty. Because we live in an age that is catastrophic and a bit apocalyptic. The close of the last century, two great scientists of that time, Claude Bernard and Émile Boutroux, visited the French publisher Goncourt. And they said to Goncourt, "We have just begun to lisp the alphabet of destruction. And in the next century, we shall have completed the alphabet. We will be able to destroy the world." And Goncourt said, "And when that day comes, I think that God will come down from heaven like a night watchman, rattling his keys. And he will say, 'Gentlemen, it's closing time.' And then we'll have to start all over again. And I tell you, if there's ever a mushroom cloud, it begins to make its appearance again in the world and swells and swells and swells in shape. Even the affluent bourgeois atheists will get down on their knees and say, 'Lord, save us, we perish.'"
I know that many of you will have questions that you would like to address to Bishop Sheen. Is there a first person who would like to? Sir.
You've told us that our emotional faculties tell us that there is a God because we appeal to him when we're in trouble. Can you tell us any intellectual reason for believing that the fact that we do appeal to him proves to us that he does exist?
Actually, in answer to the question, I did not say it was the emotional approach that we use to God, but we did use the intellectual, and now you ask for an intellectual approach, an argument, isn't that right? For God.
Justification for saying that because we appeal to God, not intellectually, but in some way, and we, like the woman in the park, who didn't say that. You told her because she was calling that God, because she was saying that he doesn't exist. Yeah. He must exist. Now, can you tell me why this has to be so? That because he does appeal to him, or tries to negate him, he has to exist.
If I understand your question, you are asking for some kind of an approach, aren't you, to God?
The proof of the station that because we appeal to him, because the lady does say that he does not exist, proof that that means that he must exist. Proof that he must exist because she appeals to him, because she says that he does not exist.
Why does the denial of God, in the case of the woman to whom you spoke in church, imply his existence? I think that's the question. That's
oh, yes.
Being
I thought that I gave the argument for that when I say that there are certain negations which we make which necessarily imply an affirmation. For example, if you said, I am non-existent, I would immediately have to say that that implied some kind of an existence. Otherwise, you could never affirm that you didn't exist. And so there are certain denials that do imply affirmations.
You apply this to the unicorn, I can say a unicorn does exist. Does that mean that the unicorn does? I guess the unicorn does not exist. Does that mean that it does?
No, because the unicorn is, first of all, a figment of the imagination. But the proofs for the existence of God are not based upon figments of the imagination, but begin with being, the fact of existence. And that's the reason I use that in the example. For example, let me take the argument of being. Our being expands in three kinds of ways: in life, and in truth, love of truth, and in love of love. Those are the three things that our being wants. We just can't get along without these three. And we don't want life for just 5 more minutes. We want it to go on. We want truth, and not just the truths of geography, to the exclusion of the truths of science. We want to know all truth. And finally, we want love, and a love without satiety and the hate. Now we find that this existence of ours, that once life and truth and love, is mixed up with a lot of imperfection and almost non-existence. For example, life is mixed up with death. Truth is mixed up with error. Love is mixed up with hate. Well, as a rational being, I must ask myself, where did I get these fractions? Via part of them, there ought to be a whole somewhere. It's very much like looking for light. Where's the source of light that is in this room? Not under the table. Because their light is mingled with shadow. It's not under the stage. Because their light is mingled with darkness. And so my reason says, if I'm to find the source of my being, of the life and the truth and the love, which I have and which I want, it must be in a life that is not mingled with the shadow death. It must be in a truth that is not mingled with the shadow error. It must be in a love that is not mingled with the shadow satiety. It must be something that's pure life, pure truth, pure love, and that's the definition of God. And that is how an affirmation of life implies perfect life, an affirmation of truth implies a truth, and an affirmation of love implies that the love that we have in this earth is simply a spark that is caught from the flame of love, which is God.
James H.C. Bernard. The late, the great Dr. Houghton of Harvard, the anthropologist, I believe I'm quoting correctly, he described man as a species, generically, as an animal organism which has evolved through the impact of shifting environments upon a variable hereditary endowment. Can you add to that from your sphere?
Again, if I understand the question aright, you want me to develop the idea that man has evolved from lower environment. And what is the future development? Is that right? Yes. Well, first of all, I believe in evolution. Therefore, I would believe in the evolution of the body of man. I find that every single thing in this universe has within itself a capacity for further development, such as Teilhard de Chardin has developed in his phenomenon of man. There is a growth in complexity. Matter becomes more and more complex. Maybe out of it evolves life, and out of life there evolved some kinds of sentiency. Now, the body of man has in some way developed too, and from some lower organisms. Way which particular animal, we do not know for certain, but I, for one, would subscribe totally to the view that the body of man was evolved from a lower animal. I would, however, say that there's something in man that did not evolve from him, and that is his intellect and his will. Because there are two things that you find in man which completely differentiates him from the animal kingdom. One is art and the other is laughter. One is art. I shouldn't be talking about art, but it is a good example. One is art. You never find, for example, a horse drawing a picture badly and a monkey beginning to draw it better. You just don't find any such thing as art until you come to someone who has the ability to project the ideal through the real. And that implies, therefore, something that is not in the lower animal kingdom. The other would be laughter. No animal laughs. The hyena has its mouth open. The horse never gives a horse laugh. Now, what is this mysterious quality in man which differentiates him even in the light of evolution? Now, I have to think of something that would... Will you laugh if I tell you something? You've got to laugh, otherwise I can't go on with my argument. A little girl was asked by a neighbor lady, "What are you going to do when you get as big as your mother?" She said, "Diet." Well, now thanks. That saves my argument. Now think of what goes on in the human mind when one uses the word big. Big is here used in a double sense. It is used in the sense of age and mental development, and it is also used in the physical sense of size. So that a human mind has got to be able to interpenetrate these two ideas. In every pun, two ideas are held together. I can't put this glass inside of this picture, mingle the two so they're one, because they're material. So that if we are to put two ideas together at once to form a pun, we have to have some spirituality. That is why laughter might be defined as the unexpected. This isn't a funny definition. The unexpected juxtaposition of two ideas, such as the two ideas that I gave. So in answer to your question, I totally subscribe to the evolution of the organism of man, but when I come, however, to the intellect of man, I then say this must have come from somewhere else and not from the lower organism. Now, Teilhard de Chardin goes much farther than this in his evolution. Teilhard de Chardin holds that as the whole evolutionary process becomes more and more complex, that there is a preparation for man, and then the development of the humanity is a preparation for Christ. And then he goes on completely to the spiritual order, and it is very interesting that the preface to that particular book was written by the eminent scientist Huxley.
The most spiritual use of a pun I've ever heard. Is there another question?
Sir, my name is Daniel Kane. I'm from the law school. In recent months, there's been a lot of publicity given to a group of modern Christian theologians who claim to derive from Paul Tillich, and I believe their leader is Mr. Altizer at Emory University in Georgia. And they propound a position that Christianity in the modern world gains a new life if God is excised as the symbol around which Christianity centers itself, is followed. I was wondering if you could, discuss your evaluation of their position in light of your analysis of atheists as bourgeois and existential, and how you would categorize them.
Well, first of all, I'm not so sure that Dr. Altizer derives his theory from Tillich. Partly, maybe, because Tillich wanted a God beyond God. Bonhoeffer wanted a religionless religion. As I understand this professor from Emory University, he may have one of two points of view, one of which is right and the other of which is wrong. If this be his position, he is right. Namely, the metaphysical, traditional way that we have been expounding the idea of God simply does not affect any communication with the modern soul. There is a certain amount of justification in that. I can remember when I was a boy, my catechism question was, what is God? God is a pure spirit, infinitely perfect. Well, I'm sure that my 7-year-old mind didn't grasp that. I accepted it more in faith than anything else. So if Dr. Altizer is taking this position and wanting a more modern and better aggiornamento for our exposition of divinity, then I can follow his argument. If, however, his argument is that the world, it's much better to have a humanity without God, I find this, first of all, in the political order, that wherever you have had an atheistic state, you have had a denial of freedom. As Dostoevsky said, unbounded liberty leads to unbounded tyranny.
You have been listening to recorded highlights of the topic, God and the Intellectual. Our guest speaker was the Most Reverend Fulton J. Sheen, Auxiliary Bishop of New York and National Director of the Society for the Propagation of the Faith. The moderator was the Reverend Charles Price, preacher to the university. The Harvard Law School Forum is a presentation of WHDH Public Affairs.